How do you feel when someone keeps their promise to you? Or what about when they let you down? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Brant Berglund, your host and study guide author, and we're continuing our study in the biblical idea of the covenant. And it's a 13-week study, and we're already in week four. My conversation partners this quarter are Dr. Alden Thompson and Sean Carpenter. They are both colleagues of mine here at Walla Walla University in the School of Theology. We have the privilege of teaching young people and helping them explore through the Bible and theological concepts. Our topic today, the everlasting covenant that God makes with Abraham. But before we get there and we think about God's covenant with Abraham, I want to come back to that opening question. How do you feel when someone keeps their promise to you? Let's start with that. How does it make you feel? What emotions come up when someone keeps their word?
Can I flip your question?
Yeah.
What about how do I feel when I keep my promise to someone? And how do I feel when I let someone down?
Okay, so you want to make it about yourself. Go ahead. Let's hear it.
Yeah. And I think for me, keeping a promise to someone else has more of an impact on me than when someone else keeps their promise to me. And I think part of it is because if I keep my promise to you, I'm putting forth some kind of energy or some kind of work that feels good. And there's this sense of accomplishment and this sense of relationship that's come out of this. And likewise, when someone else lets me down, I can give them grace. And unless it's egregious, even then, I can find space, maybe, to give them grace. But when I let someone else down, it's very difficult for me to give yourself grace.
And then you beat yourself up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Alden, what do you think about this? How do you feel when someone keeps their promise to you?
Well, I think of stories. I think especially extraordinary events. I think wasn't there one of the South Pole explorers? He said, I will be back. Mm. And the hope of that promise, I've forgotten which one it was, but you know, finally when he came back, you know, they lived for the hope that he would keep his promise, even though it looked very grim.
Hmm.
And I think we probably too easily find reasons for breaking our promises. They're simply not valued as much as in the good old days. And even in the business world, it's kind of interesting. I don't know whether they still do this, but if I think Safeway, for instance, if they put the wrong price on something, way low, nope, that was the price, that's what we'll sell it to you for.
If it's marked, if it's listed there, you get it at that point.
The real question is, what about in the academic world? What if you put the wrong thing in your syllabus?
Yeah,
you say the wrong thing in class.
You get called on it, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think about the promises made by politicians, you know, maybe just to get votes I'm not taking any sides either now or months ago, but it just seems to me that when we think about promises, promises made and promises kept, I know when I think about promises that have been made to me by friends when I was younger, it made me feel valuable. That they would actually take the time to promise me something, me. Who am I that they would promise me something? Hmm. And then that they would follow through with it. And then those times when they've let me down, and I think like you, Sean, I tend to be more gracious with other people that way than I am with myself. I'm prone to beating myself up if I don't do that which is expected of me.
Yeah.
But it does seem in some ways like promises are intended to get results, and they have a way of making us feel. And when we think today about our study, the man Abram, first of all, my father is exalted, his name means, or something like that. God came to Abraham several different times in his life and made a covenant, made a promise with him. And the beginning of our quarterly this week talks a bit about the name of God, that God had not really made his name known before this. And the same thing in Exodus, God says it again, look, I haven't really made my name known, but he does reveal himself. And Alden, I remember, it's been 20-some years ago, my very first Hebrew class was with you. And it was one of the quarters where you started Hebrew for us, and then I think Doug Clark took over. And one of the first words we learned was the divine name, the Tetragrammaton. Can you tell us a little bit about that divine name? Why might it be significant, or where what it comes from?
Well, it's first explained to Moses, and the way it's usually translated there is it doesn't really say it's the great I am, but looked at it more specifically is basically I am who I am. You can hardly wait to find out what I'm going to be.
It's almost a mysterious type of name.
Oh, it's very mysterious, sure.
And yet God gave a name, and it's interesting today how we've lost even the pronunciation of that because of how sacred the Jewish people have held the name. They see the name and they say Adonai, they say the Lord instead of the divine name.
Well, the way they came at that is very curious too, because when they went into captivity, Israel in the captivity of 586, they finally realized that they were going into captivity because they had broken God's law.
Yeah.
So they vowed that we're going to keep God's law, and they actually did what the Jews thought, putting a fence about the law. And when they came to the command, says, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, they said, well, the way we'll do that is we'll just not use his name
at
all.
Yeah. So they never crossed the fence, let alone get to it near the cliff edge.
Yeah.
So it's... But the name, in fact, I think there's only one modern translation that actually uses Yahweh, usually uses one of the circumlocutions of Lord or something like that, and that's the Jerusalem Bible, New Jerusalem Bible.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, God shows up to Abram, and I'm trying to envision this in chapter 12. The story of Abram contextually comes right after the story of the Tower of Babel, which in some ways is another fall account, right? It's this disobedient group of people, kind of parallel to the beginning of chapter 6 with the flood and kind of parallel to Adam and Eve being kicked out of the garden. But then we come to God's call, and the text jumps right into Abram, and it says, and God called Abram and said, I want you to leave the place where you live and I want you to go where I'm showing you. And it says, and Abraham got up and went. Come on, is it that simple? Was it really that easy? Or is the text leaving out some significant human details?
Well, you know, we just don't have many experiences. Most of us don't have experiences where we hear God's voice.
Yeah.
I think of the call of Isaiah, for example. In Isaiah 6. And Isaiah had a huge sound and light show God put on. I mean, just scared the daylights out of him. And God says, who will go for me? Here I am. I will go. I think if I had that kind of sound and light show, I would respond too. So it's very interesting to see how people will respond to God, and that's part of the biblical account, and it happens again and again.
And yet, when was the last? Yeah, you said we don't hear the voice of God. When was the last time you heard? Mm. I mean, was it audible? Does the text doesn't even tell us, does it?
Well, if you heard the voice of God, would you be brave enough to follow a voice in the middle of the night?
I would wonder what voice was talking to me first, wouldn't I? I mean, Samuel, Eli is calling me. No, it's God. How will I recognize his voice, right? We believe in a great controversy where there are other evil spirits that have access to people. Could it be a deception? Could it be the wrong voice? What do you think, Sean?
Well, I even back up a little bit, and I think, what were the cultural implications for Abraham to follow God's call? And what are the cultural implications for us to to follow God's call. What does that actually mean? Let's say that we believe very strongly that God has called us and we know it's God. So then the next thing we have to get over is kind of this whole socio-cultural barrier of, am I crazy?
Oh, you're hearing voices, are you?
I'm hearing voices in my head. I don't know. Maybe Alden can answer this, or either of you. What were the cultural implications of Abraham just getting up and going? God called me. I'm going. Bye.
Yeah. Leave your home. Leave your family. Leave what you've known. It includes leaving the culture, leaving the gods and the religion, I mean, the land that you know.
Did people do that as often?
Well, it seems to me, and I think of a passage in C.S. Lewis' Screwtape Letters where he talks about the willingness to act without evidence. And he says, and of course in Screwtape Letters, it's backwards theology all the way through. Screwtape is the head devil, and he is training Wormwood, his nephew, to help capture the patient, and the patient is the human being, see? God is the enemy. And at one point he says, "Do not be deceived, Wormwood. Our cause is never more in danger than when a human being, no longer desiring, but still intending to do our enemy's will, looks round on a universe from which all trace of him seems to have vanished, asks why he has been forsaken, but still obeys."
Yeah.
To be able to follow God in the absence of his presence, I think, is the great test. In fact, that quotation is preceded by this one. He wants them to learn to walk, and he must therefore take away his hand. And it's just the will to walk is there. He is pleased even with their stumbles. So to be able to be so convinced of God's presence that we will do what is right, even when the heavens are as brass, that's a terribly important perspective.
And Abraham does get up and go without... We often read the Bible and believe that God showed up to Abraham many, many, many times. But if I count them, there's really only three or four main places where God intersects with Abraham's life.
And if you take the chronology seriously, they are decades in between.
Exactly, yes. And the passages we would look at today in detail for the lesson this week, really Genesis 12, the call, Genesis 15, where God really informs Abram, look, I'm going to be the one who gives you offspring from your own body. And then chapter 17, after Abram and Sarah try to use Hagar to fulfill God's promises, right? Mm-hmm. Chapter 17, and God says, no, it's going to be through Sarah. And Abraham believes God, and God credits it to him as righteousness. These different places, yeah, decades, and yet he follows anyways. Is it possible that sometimes we believe that true spirituality means we're going to hear God every second of every day, and we're just kind of like little robots being controlled by God's, you know, remote control?
I hear the voices of, well, I was going to blame my students, but maybe I should just blame myself, because sometimes I say the same thing. Oh, it seems like God isn't acting in my life lately. Is God there? Is God real? And I think it's encouraging to hear that it was decades between God's major interactions with one of the greatest people in the Bible.
And yet, that experience of periodically, long distance, periodically hearing God's voice wasn't enough to keep Abraham in the straight and narrow. He did all kinds of foolish things, but God didn't give up on him.
It's true, and I wonder how much the covenant promises of God buoyed Abraham up through some of those things. What can we talk about those? What are those? What are the main promises that God made to Abram? What are the things that he offered him?
Well, your descendants will be like the sands of the sea.
That's maybe the one that would have been the hardest for him to accept, right? Abram was old.
Physically impossible, or at least very difficult.
Now, Abram later does have other children, even after Sarah dies. So we might say, well, the problem wasn't Abram's, it was Sarah's. She was past the age of menopause, she couldn't have children. But the text suggests that Abram could not have children until God fixed his impotence or whatever the problem was, his age, and he fixes Sarah's womb at the same time, and they end up having this child of promise, right? Mm-hmm. And what else? Okay, so children, your children will be like the sand of the seashore. Like,
well, there's
the stars
a part of being a blessing to other people, to other nations. That's a huge promise.
And the land.
Say that again, Alden.
The land.
The land.
Yeah.
What land specifically? Because we have a little difference between the Old and New Testament, sort of, don't we? I mean, the Old Testament says Abraham went up on a mountain and looked around, and he was able to see the land of Palestine. He says, all right, yeah. God gave it to me. Great. The New Testament says that he looked and his eye, like, went around the whole globe. Hebrews 11, he saw the whole earth and said, God's given me everything. So land, lots of offspring, and your offspring will be a blessing to the world. So we don't have a lot of time to talk about these, but how might these promises be fulfilled to Abraham? Did he see the promises come true in his lifetime?
No.
Well, he sure tried to make them happen. He tried to help God out. And his idea of how God was going to get it done didn't quite work so well.
In fact, it brought a lot of misery, even to this very day, maybe.
Sure. Well, Hebrews 11 is one which is, you know, has all kinds of strange things under the heading, by faith.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So one has to be a bit cautious about driving too many clear boundaries.
Yeah, we think about Abram's perspective here and being told you're going to have a child, and he wasn't able to physically, and yet it implies something about obedience, I guess we could say here.
Yeah.
He and Sarah had to go be intimate, right? I mean, as an old couple, they still had to go find a way to fulfill the promise together, and God somehow made that happen. And I can't help but wondering what that did to their marriage in their old age. I wonder, did it spark new romance? Did it, in bringing the child, it certainly brought joy to Sarah, right?
Yeah.
And laughter, as they named their son Laughter, right? Isaac, they named him Laughter. How are these promises fulfilled in Jesus? How do we see these promises fulfilled in Christ? And in some ways, we're already jumping to the very end of the quarterly, but land, offspring, a blessing to the nations. How do we see these fulfilled in Christ, or what Jesus promises, or how he extends these blessings?
Well, there is a sense in which the promises of localized promises to Abraham were transcended in Jesus. You don't have a specific land anymore. The whole world is given to the followers of Jesus.
Didn't Jesus' Sermon on the Mount touch on that?
Yeah.
The meek will inherit the earth, right?
Yeah.
Not the land of Palestine. Yeah. They'll inherit the earth.
Yeah.
So, it's broader. It expands.
Well,
and
I think what gets me every time I think about Jesus is that he flips everything upside down. And everything that we expected, God's going to make me rich. Maybe that's not what God's going to do. Maybe he'll do something better.
Maybe the wealth will come in other ways than money.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when I think about the offspring, and there's an interesting passage in Isaiah 53 where it says, and if it's prophetic, we think Isaiah 53 is pointing towards the Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
He will see his offspring. Even though we know Jesus didn't have any children, if it's talking about Jesus prophetically, then certainly his offspring seems to be those by faith, spiritually, who join into the lineage of the Messiah. How big a group is that? That's a great multitude, which no one can count.
Well, the other thing is the expectation. It's really fascinating because the people of Jesus' time, everyone expected a Messiah. The only question was what kind.
Okay. Yeah.
And they wanted to have a warrior Messiah. And Jesus, we don't know how, But Isaiah 53 is not addressed to Messiah. It just is the suffering servant. The
servant, yeah.
And Jesus somehow was directed by the Spirit to say, that's my mission.
That's me.
And when he told the people that he must suffer and die, nobody believed him. Nobody. It wasn't until after the resurrection that finally they were that's what he meant. Yeah.
There again, Jesus flips everything on his head. And everything that we think about how life should be, even now, he turns it completely upside down.
Yeah. And he makes something more beautiful out of it. We'll talk more about the blessing to the nations later, but kind of want if we need to finish up. I think our time is about finished here for this week, but thinking about God calling Abram and telling him, you're going to have a child from your own body. And it says in the text that Abram believed God and it was credited to him as righteousness. That idea of crediting righteousness to somebody who, as you have noted earlier in our conversations, Alden, this Abram was not what we would call just a normal righteous dude, right? He had some problems. He was weak-willed. He was fearful. He was maybe even aggressive at times. And yet here he is trusting God and finally saying, okay, I'll take you at your word. I'm not sure there's a better definition of faith in all of Scripture. Taking God at his word. God says, this is what I'm going to do for you. And finally, Abram says, okay, I'll trust that you do that. Boy, how many times does God have to get me to, you know, knock on my head before I'll trust him? I can do this for you. Yeah. I think our time is about up today for this study. I want to thank you again, Alden and Sean, for joining me in this conversation. Thanks also to Samuel Schaffner and our whole program engineering team. And thank you to all of you for listening in. For the Good Word, I'm Brant Berglund.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.